Thank you. So, Bill, would you like to speak about what it is we're going to do this weekend?
Well, we kind of came up with a lot of you have heard us do our sponsorship thing, so we thought we would go through the steps. And each one of us kind of individually does workshops and retreats and stuff around the country. And so we got together and we thought about it a little bit, and we don't get much time to sit down with each other unless we're here. And we came up with a rough format, and we thought what we'd do is, in the morning we'll start off with 1, 2, and 3. The second meeting tomorrow morning we do 4 and 5, and so on through the weekend. And maybe we can. And for each session, what we put down here is Q&A, questions and follow-ups or comments. So, and this is really nice for a small group. Maybe through the weekend we'll get a little bit tighter and more snuggly. A small group, it's hard for somebody to start off asking a question, but just take a plunge, you know, or make a comment, something you want to bring to the table, because it'd be nice to interact a little bit, and that'll kind of guide the course of the weekend, you know, as you participating in our weekend. You know, it's not just us, just you sitting here listening. You know, if you've got something to say or a question, please feel free. So that's kind of what we did. You know, we thought we'd start off this evening, we'd just tell you a little bit about our stories, and we're not going to go through the whole god-awful story, you know. I mean, it's, you know, we're just going to go kind of about what it was like, because what we're going to be talking about is what happened and what it's like now and during the course of the weekend, so the whole story will come out. Good?
Good.
We wrote up a format. We have an official, and I tell you,
hours.
I promise you, we are more than willing to throw this thing away.
And one of the other things that I'd like to say is that what you've got here is some guys that have some experience and some strength, and I think more than anything, from that experience, strength is we have a well of hope in any life situation that you can have. And that is what we bring to the kitchen table more than anything, is this wellspring of hope. And we're not going to be speaking about how to do the steps correctly.
Well, maybe
Bill
bit.
Will.
we're not. Yeah.
But anyway, so Matthew, why don't you lead off?
Matthew, and I'm an alcoholic. I just feel like I could just soak in the energy. But so my plan for tonight for me is that we're going to take about 15 minutes each. I'm just going to tell you about what it was like until the moment I worked my first step, and then leave it and the other men will speak. And then, but like Bill said, when we get into the steps, the rest will unfold. But I think it's really important. When I speak around in at conferences and things, I always want to kind of get to the recovery part quickly because it seems so urgent and important. So it's really nice to take an evening and let you see what alcoholism looked like in my life. Maybe you can relate to that, or so that you trust the recovery process. It's just a pleasure to be able to take the time. So, I'm the youngest of four children in an Irish Catholic family, which is a privileged place to be born, because people are always picking you up and kissing you, and lots of music and stories. My dad was a great storyteller, Irish guy, first generation off the boat, second generation. His parents were Irish, and I was the youngest by a long shot. I was 7 years born after my brother, so I was an Irish surprise. I'm always grateful Catholics don't believe in birth control. Man, my other brothers and sisters were 1 year apart, and my parents weren't alcoholics, and I always try to be really clear that my parents are really good people, because I sponsor a lot of men, and I know that that's not really true for everybody, and that there's a lot of chaos, but my mom and dad were not alcoholics. My father told me on his deathbed that his dad knew the guy who started my club. And it turns out Bill Wilson had some interaction with my grandfather who died of alcoholism in 1942. So, but there was alcoholism in my home. So my parents, my mom was a school teacher, my dad had his own business and went to work before we woke up, and he got home about 8 o'clock at night because he was terrified he wasn't going to get us all to college. And just kind of a nice, I thought, functional home. And my brothers and sisters were good people, but my brother, 7 years older than me, the one next up, my hero, you know, he looked like Paul McCartney and he played the drums, and he was a raging drunk by the time he was about 15. And he was stealing the car, and he anytime we got anything nice, he'd destroy it. Like my dad bought a boat and my brother ran it into the Redondo Beach Pier. And none of us were on the boat. That was a little ride Neil took by himself. Stuff like that. But I saw when I was a kid that alcohol was his problem, you know, and because I was a little kid, and little kids have pretty clear vision. And I loved him. I wanted to be him. But he caused all these problems in my house. There was a lot of yelling and screaming in my house because of him. And I would say, you know, why don't you quit drinking? And he'd say, you just don't understand. It's not, it has nothing to do with drinking. It's mom and dad. It's the times. Everything's screwed up. So as a result, I didn't drink when most people were drinking early in high school and all that. But I had that thing that a lot of people I've heard speak have. I was real thin. I had really bad acne. And I had this feeling that I wasn't, that people hung out with me like they were doing me a favor. They hung out with me out of pity, which is interesting because I had the same 6 friends from first grade till now, and I'm 48 years old, and they're really hanging in there for the pity thing. But we grew up in a small Catholic school, and you kind of, we were a little bit, it was like a private club because people didn't understand it and made fun of us, so you kind of hung together. And so I played guitar. My mom gave me a guitar because I couldn't throw a ball. I was lousy at sports. I loved to read Henry David Thoreau, and I loved to play my guitar. So I was weird. You know, I felt like a weird kid. And my senior year, those 5 guys were sitting around with me, and we were in a house in Hermosa Beach. And my brother was particularly awful during that time. He'd gotten a girl pregnant, and he had run off, and they were getting married. And by that time, he'd already ended up out of his car. He was living in his car. And he'd been thrown out of that house, too. So there's a lot of chaos. And they got a bottle of tequila. My friends got a bottle of tequila when the parents had gone away, and we were at this house on the beach in Hermosa Beach, and they started taking shots of tequila, and I just couldn't stand it anymore. It wasn't that I wanted to drink. I just didn't want to be different anymore. You know, I didn't want to drink. Drinking seemed to me like a bad thing. But these guys were regular guys, and I want to be clear, they never pressured me. They never said, come on. They loved me. You know, they wanted me to be comfortable. But I was so uncomfortable when they started drinking, I said, hey, I'll take a shot of that. And they were like, wow, really? You never do. Okay. And, you know, I loved describing the next moment to my tribe, you know, because you guys know what happened, right? I took that shot of tequila, and 12 years of Catholic school guilt just melted out of my shoulders, you know, and I wasn't a bad, evil person. And my acne disappeared. Amazing. And I was funny and articulate, and I could say stuff that they could relate to. I didn't have to quote Thoreau for a minute. And it was amazing. I just can't, my chest got warm, and I'm no dummy. You know, I got a much bigger glass. Came back to the table. I want more of the magic elixir. And I actually thought of John Lennon when he said every world leader should take acid. I thought, I hope everybody's drinking this stuff because this would really help. And, you know, that kind of like euphoric experience. And I drank a lot of tequila that night, and there were 6 of us, and I had to go to the bathroom. I'd never been drunk, and the whole room and the whole house, it suddenly became like a cruise ship, you know, it was rolling, and I didn't understand, and I went down to the bathroom, and I sat down in the toilet to go to the bathroom, and the room started to spin, and I'm a Catholic kid, right, raised pretty in a religious family, and my last thought before I blacked out was that God would not make your body so that you could defecate and vomit at the same time. You know, that'd be a flaw in design, and God's perfect. And I was wrong. Absolutely. Yeah. And I lurched towards the sink, and that's all I remember. And the best part of the story is I woke up in the morning in a sleeping bag with a pillow under my head like I'd gone camping in the bathroom. I was like, no. I guess this is where I crashed. And my friends had found me in between functions.
We had that moment in our life where it was just the worst moment ever. And I think that's what you look for in a fifth step, when some guy does a fifth step with you, you know? And you're not looking for the glory things like robbing a liquor store and stuff. I mean, you're looking for that real demoralizing moment, you know, where you compromise everything that you believe in. And, you know, I got raised in AA, which is a little bit different. My parents were good people, too, you know. They were good people. They were a little self-centered. And I'm an only child, and they weren't really that interested in me. But a strange thing happened when I was 6 years old. My dad got sober. And he got involved, and my mother got involved. My mother got real active in Al-Anon. And I got raised in AA meetings. And I've been to all the potlucks and the conventions and all that stuff, you know. And what was really going on in my house in the mid-50s was that those people were part of a larger group of people that were building the AA on the west coast of the United States that we now all enjoy. And I remember that time with great fondness now. Now I know what was going on. At the time when you're a kid, it's just the lame shit that your parents are doing, you know. I mean, the people were nice, though. Like, when I finally got to AA when I was 37, the one thing I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous was that it was a safe place. That it was a happy place, you know, because I knew all the people. And I knew it wasn't just a bunch of old people sitting under a bridge or hanging around in meetings, you know, hanging on to each other and not drinking. You know, like a lot of us tell that story, they didn't know what AA was. Well, I knew what AA was. I just didn't want to come. You know, I mean, because I knew that what they do there in AA is they don't drink. And I could not comprehend not drinking. You know, I think we all feel that way. And then you get to the other side of it when you're actually not drinking and you look back on that and you go, yeah, why did I feel so strong? Because it's so easy not to drink when the obsession gets taken away. If the obsession hasn't been taken away, it's hell. It's awful. And so I got raised in AA, but by the time I was 17 years old, I was a bad drunk in high school. I was the kind of kid that you could not talk to. I was trouble. I was the one behind the backstop smoking cigarettes when everybody else was playing sports, you know. I mean, I was that kid. I always wanted to be a gangster ever since I can remember. I just wanted to be a bad guy, a tough guy, you know. It really looked good to me. And it looked like they were having a good time. I felt that was my identity, you know. I mean, I grew up in the times of Westerns, you know. And we'd watch Bonanza and Gunsmoke and stuff. And the bad guys always looked cooler. You ever notice that? They dressed cooler. You know, the good guys, their gun was up too high. And they had the big dumbass looking hat. And the bad guy was just all sneery and slouchy and had that shabby old hat on and his thing in rhinestones and stuff and big spurs. And he was loud and he had a cigar hanging out of his mouth. And he was half shit-faced, you know. I mean, it was like, yeah, let's be that guy, you know. And at 17, I'd already been to jail, and I carried a little gun around with me sometimes. I was a surfer and a biker and a tough guy, and I never went to the beach. My motorcycle rarely ran, and I was afraid to fight. But I looked really good, man. I had a chrome Nazi helmet for a hat and a primary chain for a belt and black greasy Levi's and big black boots with chains around them. I've got tattoos all over me, but I had a clip-on earring because I didn't want to hurt myself, you know. And my biker nickname was Horny. And I have it tattooed on my arm right here. You can see it for a quarter. I'll show it. And it's misspelled. It's H-O-R-N-E-Y. Horney. We were just talking earlier. I showed it to Matthew. He'd actually never seen it because we try to not see each other naked.
Twice a year.
And And there three of us made the decision on the spelling, myself, my friend, and the tattoo artist. And we came to that conclusion, the three of us rocket scientists, that that's how you spell horny. And I was stealing my parents' car when I was 13 or 14 years old. I think the first time I got really good and drunk, like Matthew's story, I think I was late 14, maybe early 15. Because, you know, you, before that, you'd like sipping on beers, and you might get a little buzz here and there, but you, finally, you get the job done. You know, you do what you and I do. You get good and hammered, you know, because it was never about just mellowing out and stress relief, you know. It was never about sitting on the beach with everybody and just having a couple of beers and kind of relaxing into the afternoon's beach volleyball session, you know. You know, it was never about standing on the veranda in your beautiful home because you're highly successful and you've got a martini in your hand as the sun is setting in the distance, you know. It was never about that. It was always about leaving the area, you know, like I'm drinking for the blackout. I want out of here. I don't like this place. You've created this reality. I don't get along well, and I want to go. I want to leave. Blackouts were not a problem for me, you know. I mean, it just wasn't a big deal. And I don't think I ever tried to control my drinking. I would sometimes go into packs with my wives, depending upon which one I was with, about how we might control it and kind of tone it down. And what that meant to me was, is that when we go to the party or the event, we kind of keep it cool, because afterwards we're going to get hammered. You know, when she goes to bed or something, we're going to finish it off. Because once I get started, it has to run its course. And I'm all there for it. There's no internal struggle going on with me. You know, I want that. And at 17, I was a bad drunk in high school. And at 22 years old, I was in the Oregon State Mental Institution. Now, that's a short party. You know, I mean, at 17, I was already in trouble. I'd already been in jail at 17. I mean, I started really drinking when I was 15. So things went south right away. I mean, right away. It became a lifestyle for me right away. It's like Matthew telling the story of, you know, getting sick on the tequila and then you don't drink anymore. I missed that part. I just kept right on going. My story is the one, like, I couldn't wait to do it again. And I got sick. I threw up in my record player. Well, back in those days, record players, they were pieces of furniture, you know. They had lids on it. So I puked in the record player, you know. It seemed to make sense at the time. And I can remember waking up the next day. I remember quite clearly wondering when this was going to happen again. How are we going to get this together? Because the way we got it before was my friend had an older brother that had the booze. So right away, I started grinding on this. And when you're little, it's hard to get booze. But, you know, many, many times hanging around the liquor store waiting for that guy that'll buy you a six-pack, you know, and keep the change. And finally, we met the guy that was sleeping in his car behind the gas station. And you could give him a few bucks, you know, and he'd go get you a six-pack and keep the change. And it was a good deal, you know, so we used him a lot. And he disappeared. He died, you know. And so by the time I'm 22, I'm in a mental institution, locked down, barbed wire on the top of the fence, mental institution. Right across the street from the state penitentiary, so you can see where you're coming from or going to, one or the other. And I had gotten married, and I had two children, and I'm running with an outlaw motorcycle gang, and I'm sticking needles in my arm every day, and I'm drinking like a fish, and it was awful. They were on welfare. I wasn't coming home. They didn't know where I was. I was out on Highway 99 outside of Eugene, Oregon one time shooting dope in this old motor hotel, and my wife came and found me and came and knocked on the door. It was winter time. There was snow on the ground, and she came with tears in her eyes and said, "Would you please come home?" You know, she couldn't pay the bills. She didn't have any money. She wasn't working. She had these two small kids, and I did not go home. I didn't go home. I haven't thought about that in a long time. I heard a young guy that led our men's meeting some time ago said that Alcoholics Anonymous is man school. You know, I think it's woman school too. I mean, I really, honestly grew up in AA, became a man in Alcoholics Anonymous, because before that I was not a man. You know, I was not a man. And has anybody else here been in a mental institution?
I'm the only one here.
No. There's a couple bumps. There's some honesty happening back there.
So I'm going to slow to go up. There's a bunch of you out there that are going, "Well, it really wasn't an institution. They were just observing me." You know? Well, it's not such a bad place, a mental institution. It's a safe place. Mm-hmm. You know, they feed you regular and give you lots of Thorazine, keep you mellowed out. Great place to look for girls. Prime hunting ground, you know. Like spirits. And I was 22 when that happened. And I had another 15 years to go. In that period of time, I came back down from Oregon, back down to Los Angeles, where I'm from. And met another woman, and we set up housekeeping. My father gave me a job in his machine shop in El Segundo, and he let me sleep in his garage. He set me up a little bedroom in the garage. And he's sober a long time by then, you know, quite a while. And I tried to get normal, and what happened, I had to quit. You got to quit shooting heroin and speed. It's just abnormal to do that. You can't find anybody to go along with the concept of social heroin use. You know, there's no support for the position, and so I had to quit. I quit all the hard drugs. I quit taking acid. I quit, you know. And what I tried to do is I tried to drink on weekends, because normal people have jobs that they go to during the week, and when I drink, I don't show up no matter what. My life stops when I drink. I don't finish college. A few years ago, I was up in Salem speaking at a convention, and I went and I found the mental institution. And I come back to the roundup thing, and I'm sitting at dinner with this other old hippie from California that never left up there in Oregon. He came up, never left, and I'm still friends with him to this day, Dan Costello, good guy. And I'm sitting next to him. I said, "Hey, you know, I was in the mental institution right down the road." And he goes, "I work there." And I went, "Of course you do. This is AA. Where else would you work?" And he took me over there and called security and said, "Leave us alone." And we found my ward and took pictures. I had my picture taken next to the sign, you know. Because some people went to college. This is all I got. Oregon State Mental Institution. It's my alma mater, you know. This graduate school, you know. And so I quit all the hard drugs, and I tried to drink on the weekends. And what you do during the week is you just smoke pot, because it's green and it's from God. And it's not really drugs.
Not really a drug.
So this, I guess, really, if you really look, I tried to control it. I was trying, that was my way of controlling it. My way of controlling it is like not quitting. We don't talk about quitting. Maybe we mix it up a little bit, you know. And in the end, at 37 years old, this second wife that I had, we had two more children. And I'm living in the house with this woman and these two kids. And I had no emotional connection to another living human being. And I didn't know that. I didn't know, You know, I've never been connected. How would I know that I was disconnected? I mean, I can't stand outside myself and have a separate experience and compare it to the one that I'm having to know that I'm not connected. This is all just in hindsight. But I had drank up my soul. I love in the doctor's opinion, Silkworth makes this really powerful comment. It struck me when I first read it, maybe not the very first time, but early on it really struck me where he says, we lose touch with all things human. Isn't that true about us, man? We unplug from the rest of the human race. We think we're separate from nature, you know, which is impossible. But we think we're separate. And Chuck Chamberlain used to draw the circle with the dots in it and one dot outside the circle. And he'd talk about conscious separation from God, you know, separate from all things, from the totality of all things. We're separate. But certainly, we believe that anyway. I certainly was not connected to other people. I couldn't feel them in my life. Children have a way of cutting through that. Like when Matthew describes that standing in there, holding that little baby can be a stunningly painful experience because there's something about them and that innocence that breaks through that and it touches something in us. And our reaction to that is one of fear and wanting to run. You know, I don't want to feel that kind of emotion. I don't know what to do with that. But I lived in the house with this wife and two kids and I had my little job at my dad's machine shop and there was no more pot. There was no more drug. There was me and a gin bottle. I'm a garden variety alcoholic that grew up in the Paisley decade. You know, I mean, I'm from the 60s, but I'm just a juicer, you know, that did whatever else was around. But in the end, there was nothing else. There was nothing else. And I was drunk from the neck down. There was no more mental and emotional relief. Remember that? You ever drank yourself clear? Boy, that was never the idea, was it? You know, and I don't know. I'm not sure what it looks like from the outside, but what happens to me when that experience happens is I'm drinking and you're not going away. There's no blackout. I'm clear as a bell. Maybe I'm slurring my words when you listen to me, but it doesn't even feel that way to me. I feel stone cold sober. I mean, people think we're joking when we say it stops working. Well, for me, it quit working. That's called hell. That's a frightening place to be. When you're addicted to the juice, you know, you can't stop drinking, but it literally isn't working anymore. That's a frightening thing. So like any good gangster, I called my mom. You know, the 30-year Al-Anon. And she came and got me. And it started my journey. You know, and my journey started March the 27th, 1985. You know, a remarkable, remarkable experience that didn't register with me for about 6 months what had happened on that day. Because on that day, you know, I woke up in that hospital that she took me to in Costa Mesa, California. And I've never touched another drink. You know, the only mind-altering chemicals I've done is when I'm in the hospital. So I try and have as many surgeries as I can.
Clear the message.
My wife tells me, she says, have fun here because you're not bringing any of that crap home. You know, lately there's been but I've not gotten high since that time. What a remarkable thing. And I think sometimes we forget how remarkable that is. That truly is a spiritual experience. Doesn't happen to everybody. You know, lots of people come into AA, try to get sober, and it doesn't click. You know, the obsession doesn't go. Maybe it does later. But my wife, God bless her, she went in and out of AA for 10 years before it finally, and she's 21 years sober now. But what a remarkable experience. I'm powerless over alcohol. I've proven it to myself over and over and over again. It is my fervent hope that I never, ever, for the rest of my life, ever drink again. I don't ever want to go back to that place. I don't want to feel that self-hatred anymore. You know, I look in the mirror today and I'm pretty much like what I see. You know, and if I don't like what I see, I'm real conscious of why I don't like it. and I have a mechanism for cleaning up whatever it is I've done, you know, that causes me to feel bad about myself. And but that's my story, and for the rest of the weekend, you know, more of it will come out. I think, like Matthew says, and Jay also, the recovery part is much more interesting, you know, because I'm sure you've related to parts of my drunkalogue. I certainly relate to yours, no matter what it is, because it all ends up in the same place, you know. So thank you very much. Jay the alcoholic.
Hey, Jay. Jay.
If you put the amount of time that we've been sober together, it's as long as the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has been in existence. Got 76 years of experience here. I had the great pleasure the other day of watching Phoebe give Matthew a cake at our 11-step group. And one of the great things about our 11-step group is the format set up so that the family can come and do that. They don't have to stay through the whole meeting and stuff. But they can come and I know that girl. Not well, but I know her. And I love her very deeply.
She's not the innocent little baby that she used to be.
The tall, lanky blonde. No.
That's the great thing. I came to you on the second day of May in 1979. And although I've found it necessary on a lot of occasions, I haven't taken the front drink, sniffed any glue, or done any of those things that I found to be so consoling. For all my family's weirdness, there's lots of alcoholism in my family. They taught me how to read when I was really young. And they taught me good table manners. And they made sure I went to school. And that I did my homework. And they introduced me to God as they understood God. And for that, I will always be grateful. When I was young, because of my father's inability to articulate and his frustration and his powerlessness and the explosive anger that would come from him occasionally, and my mother, who needed a drink really badly and didn't take it, and so a lot of the violence in the home came from the unrecovered Al-Anon. I was raised in the Episcopal Church, and I found Sunday mornings to be a place that was safe, a place that was quiet. I could say the Mass from memory by the time I was 8 because I got my dad's approval that way. It was in English. And I was the short guy in school. I don't know if you remember the short guy. I can't throw the ball as far. I can't run as fast. But when I'm 12 years old, I find something that I can do better than guys that are bigger and tougher and stronger than me. That's metabolized beverage alcohol. And I didn't realize that what I have is a disease. I don't understand that I'm different. I'm bodily and mentally different than 90% of the people on the planet. This is the baffling part of alcoholism. This is the thing that kind of sets it apart from many of the other addictions is that you can set 100 people down and give them the same amount of alcohol every day, and 10 of them, 12 of them are going to just get goofy. And the other 88 are going to still go to work and stuff. And I don't understand that. But when I started to drink, what happened is that there was this tension inside of me that released. And once it released, it never occurred to me not to get loaded. I mean, why not? And, you know, these guys actually did some things, but by the time I'm 13 years old, on my way to seventh grade, every morning, I'm getting loaded. Some days I maybe miss, but not many. Now, you start pouring that much alcohol and all the other drugs on top of that small body, and by the time I'm 15 years old, I am well on my way I'm starting to talk about the palsy that runs in my family. I took pride in being the first one to do anything. And so I'm 15 years old and I'm sticking needles in my arm. I was very, very fortunate. It was only about a 5-month period, but it was every day that I possibly could. And I particularly like shooting LSD because it gets you there now.
Yeah.
I'm not a guy that likes to wait. And I remember the horrified look of a young woman that was my friend when she found me socializing in a bathroom. And I just told her, it's just quicker. And besides, like in those days, I had to be home by 10 o'clock. I mean, I had to be home by 10 o'clock. So you got to get downtown now, and you got to get to the point that you can, you know, at least walk through the door and get up to your bedroom before, you know, without getting busted. And but what alcohol did, and when I say alcohol, please realize that I'm saying whatever it is that goes along with that, because there really wasn't any distinction in it, because when you're that young, it's really hard to get. Like, I had access to marijuana, so you gave the guy a joint and he would be happy to buy you, you know. But part of this disease that I have is a soul sickness. This thing that this guy that Bill knew and was very close with his family, Chuck Chamberlain, he talked about there's one problem in which there are all problems, in which all problems reside, and there's one solution in which all solutions reside. And for me, it's a spiritual thing. And this separation that I felt, one of my favorite pieces of AA literature is correspondence that happened between Bill Wilson and Carl Jung. And Bill wrote a letter to Jung just before Jung passed away, and he wrote a letter back to Bill. And in it, he talked about Roland Hazard, who was the man who carried the message to the guy who carried the message to Bill about spiritual principles being able to relieve alcoholism. And he was talking about this guy, Roland Hazard, and Roland's family had all the money in the world. Couldn't help the kid. Couldn't help the guy. And he said that his alcohol use on a low level was the search for the soul's completeness, for union with God. That's what alcoholism is it's a search for wholeness. And most people that I have what I like to call honest conversations with about why is it that we so desperately fall for these substances, is that it's a wholeness that I never experienced before in my life. Later on in the letter, Jung goes on to say that the helpful formula in talking about alcoholism, he says, it's interesting that in Latin, You use the same word for the highest spiritual state and the most depraving poison. He said, therefore, the helpful formula is spiritus contra spiritum. Alcohol, you know, they measure its potency in spirits. So it's the spirit of whatever, the universe, against the spirits of liquor. And that's the formula. Now, something happened 76 years ago. Something remarkable. You know, we can sit around and read the Bible or quote about, you know, weird spiritual stuff and this and that and another thing and about what the nature of a miracle is. Now, if you look in the dictionary, a miracle is an event for which there is no rational explanation. And there are people who will say that there is no such thing as spiritual healing. But 100 years ago, women and men that had this sense of not being able to be whole were doomed, were never relieved of that problem, except on very rare occasions when they aligned themselves with some religious movement and they did something and they got hit. But it was about as frequent as being hit by lightning. And yet look how much lightning has hit just in this room. 80 years ago, we're all toast. Maybe one of us gets out. Maybe. But that's a real long shot. You probably have to, you know, 10 times this for one of us to get out. But something happened. And what happened is that there were a group of people that got together that started to ask a power for help. And a couple of guys that had this problem got together, and in their fear and in their pain and in their common suffering, they asked for help and said that they would do absolutely anything necessary in order to have this burden removed. There are over 2 million women and men today just in Alcoholics Anonymous that are walking free. Right now, there are groups of twos and threes and fives in places like West Africa and Madagascar and in Australia, in the bush, that are getting together and doing this thing that we call Alcoholics Anonymous. And something's happening. And what's happening is that this problem that devastated families for since the dawn of time is being relieved. Spirit is healing. A progressive fatal illness. And everybody in this room has had it. And hopefully this weekend, what we'll do is we'll talk about how it is that this is transmitted. Because the only way that it is transmitted is by somebody that has had an experience to somebody that wants an experience. What happened to me was I ended up across a coffee table from a guy. I'd been living in my car. He talked to me about he had problems in his life and He'd met Alcoholics Anonymous, he didn't have any problems anymore. And he went on and on and on and on, and I needed to get out. I was thirsty. He'd ask me not to drink that morning or smoke any dope, and I hadn't done either, and I needed to get out of there now. And I said, do I need psychiatric treatment? Do I need religion? How about hospitalization? And he looked at me and he said, listen, Trick, if you or your family can get a hold of the $3,000 that it'll cost to put you in a program, go out and drink the money up. And when you're done, call Alcoholics Anonymous. They do it for fun and for free. And he got up and he said, if you want AA, if you want sobriety, you're going to have to want it like you wanted your drugs and your alcohol. He said, it's in the white pages of the phone book. Good luck, kid. And he left. This was before newcomers had a union. They were not nice to us. I mean, you think Gunner's bad. I mean, these were the truly heartless, not the pretend. Anyway, and what happened is that I went home and I poured myself a glass full of bourbon and I called Alcoholics Anonymous and I ended up at a noon meeting on the second day of May in 1979. And I walked in, I was half hour late, and everybody started talking at me. And I couldn't understand why they were talking at me, but I'm not really hygienically correct when I've been drinking. And my teeth are a little green and my fingernails are long, and when I've been drinking and when my hair is long, I kind of look like the Sphinx. And I hadn't had enough to drink yet, and I was starting to get the zup-zups. And it was not going to be nice. And in that meeting, everybody started talking at me, and they talked about alcoholism. They talked about the front drink. And the third guy that talked was a guy by the name of Butcher Joe. You know, he's called Butcher Joe. Literally, his name is Joe Hacker.
Yeah.
Kid you not? And he looked at me and he talked to my stepmother that killed my brother-in-law, that took my dad out probably 10, 15 years before he actually didn't drink the last year of his life. A wonderful thing. Never had to come to the silly meetings. But I'm a great fan of just physical sobriety. And I have a sister who's sober 24 years. I've got another sister who's living on the streets. She doesn't have a drug or alcohol problem. But if you met her, you'd say her and her husband, these horrible homeless people. How sad. And I know it's alcoholism, a family disease. So there is a solution. And we're going to talk about steps. But all the steps are spiritual exercises. That's all they are. And we're going to have hopefully a lot of fun. But deep down underneath, I hope that each and every one of you this weekend spends a little time thinking about the fact that if you were born in your grandparents' era, there was no hope. And today, spirit is multiplying in ways that are absolutely beyond our imagination. And are raising people from the dead as we speak. Thank you.
Does anybody have any questions or comments or anything?
Anything in there?
You want to talk about, you want to do a meditation in the morning?
Oh, yeah. Let's see. What time is breakfast?
8.
And there's nothing going on in this room, right? So from like 6 o'clock on, I'll be hanging out, meditating in this room. At 7:30, I'll do a little, I'll teach a thing called the awareness exercise. So if anybody wants to come in for that, if you want to just come in and hang out and be quiet for a little while, that's cool. But anyway, I'll be in here. And
what time?
The awareness exercise I'll do at 7:30.
I have a couple questions.
Want to do them now? Want to do a couple questions? This one's good. It says, am I powerless over people, places, and things, or just alcohol and the decision to drink? It's just my opinion, but it's a really good one. You know, just to clarify. I think we're powerless over everything. And, you know, we'll talk about this more tomorrow, but, you know, my personal experience, my understanding now after some time being sober, is that I don't think that the totality of all things requires any input from me whatsoever for the unfolding to occur. And my personal experience is I'm just, there's nothing I have any power over, and I look around in nature, I don't think anything else has any power. I think we just do what we do. The illusion is that we can control things, and the worst one that I have, and I believe most of us have, is evidently my happiness is dependent upon your behavior, because I sure spend a lot of time trying to adjust your behavior in order that we both might be happier. You know, and it's described extremely well in the Big Book, you know, where it talks about the director of the play, you know, and doesn't he cause confusion even when his intention is good? You know, I mean, I can have the most humanitarian intention in the world, but I'm attempting to adjust you, to control you, and I have no control over you. I mean, I waste an immense amount of consciousness trying to adjust the outside so that I might feel better inside. And personally, it's like coming, when we get to 6 and 7, I think I'm equally as powerless over myself. I think when Jay talks about spirit, we're not talking about willpower. You know, we're not talking about knowledge, intellectual knowledge. I think there's a knowingness that transcends the intellect. I mean, when we come to a spiritual understanding, it isn't so much what we know in our head. It's what we know that's beyond that, just kind of an innate understanding that we didn't have before. We like to call that acceptance. I think when I arrive at that place is when I'm accepting what's around me just as it is and quit labeling what I think it is, good or bad. So, and we'll talk about this some more. It's a really wonderful subject. I think it's kind of, to me, it's one of the core things about the recovery process or spirituality in general, is this idea of personal powerlessness. And I think it's over everything.
I agree with Bill. I would say it this way, the way I try to describe it to people that I work with in AA is that I'm powerless over alcohol. My life is unmanageable. That's my first step. And, you know, when I got here, I remember when they would say, you know, the prudent reserve of such and such a meeting is $83. And every time, whatever amount it was more money than I had. Every time. It's like, God, I wish I had as much prudent reserve as a AA meeting is what I would think, you know. And I had nothing. I had nothing. I had no clothes. I had no possessions. And as life has gone on in sobriety, I'm married. I have 3 children. I have a job. I sponsor a lot of people. I travel all over the world for business. And I am no more managing my life now than I did when the meeting had more money than I did. What I found through working the steps and staying active in Alcoholics Anonymous is I'm able to show up with fewer delusions for everything, but I don't manage my marriage. How could I manage my marriage?
Especially not her.
Not her. That's my wife. The type of thing is I was thinking.
You've tried.
I have tried. One day, the thing I try to do to make her feel guilty, would make her feel guilty. The next day, the same thing makes her go, "Oh, please." You know, how do you manage that? She's a human, biological person, a spiritual person, a far better person than I should have wound up with. So I never have been able to manage her. And what I'd say is, after 18 years, and I was going to say that, Phoebe turned 18 last Monday, and I turned 18 years sober, and last night she gave me a cake in front of these guys. After 18 years, I don't manage Phoebe, believe me, yeah. I don't manage Phoebe, but I get to be there and be part of it. I get my take on powerlessness is, I used to be powerless and not able to participate in life. And now I'm powerless and I'm allowed to participate. That's the difference. The other question is, how can I get over the horrible things I did? And I think we're going to address this a lot, too, this weekend. You want to start, Jim?
I have had the great pleasure to be with some of the people that founded the consciousness of Alcoholics Anonymous in Southern California. And to listen to them and to learn from them. And one of them was a man by the name of Jack Prose. Jack Prose was bigger than Bill. There used to be a cartoonist by the name of Gary Larson, the Far Side. He'd draw these great big guys, you know, with kind of a hunchback and lots of... That was Jack Prose. And Jack...
He was the Pope of AA.
and Jack was a powerfully physical man. And when he was 16 years old, he crippled his two best friends drunk driving in Colorado. By the time he's 20, he's a hobo. And he killed at least two men that he knew of that wouldn't share their booze with him. Threw him off the train and kept the booze. And he did not know how it was that he could possibly live with that. And what his sponsor told him was, don't drink and say yes to Alcoholics Anonymous. And this man started the institutional committees in Southern California, going into prisons, going into hospitals, not trying to pay for his sins, but just following the lead and just humbly doing what was put in front of him next. Touched hundreds of thousands of people. And somehow he was able to sleep at night. I have had the privilege of hearing a lot of fifth steps. And I have heard, I believe, every experience that a human can have. And it is my sincere belief that the steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous will provide you with the opportunity to have peace. Part of this journey, I don't know, is that we all in our own time learn to forgive the unforgivable. But we only are able to do that when we touch that place in us that has not been forgiven. And we are very, very fortunate to be heir to an elegant and effective way of addressing just about every problem that human beings can have.
I have a couple of things to say about this question. One is, you know, I read a quote the other day that said, the truth will set you free, but not until it's finished with you. And that's been my experience. And there was an old guy in our meeting, still around actually, Rocky. And he would say, you know, at 1 year on your fifth step, you're sober, you say, I stole some rope, you know. And at 5 years, you go, okay, there were a bunch of horses attached to it. And that's been my experience. You know, I did not even have it in my frontal lobe that I'd pushed that woman down a flight of stairs till I was 7 years sober and I did a fifth step with him. I made amends to her at 2 years sober for all the horrible things I did, but I couldn't even admit it to myself. And there's a process here at Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think there's two sides to this coin about forgiving yourself. One is you got to stop focusing on yourself, because self-loathing is as much an ego trip as self-love is. And so the journey to your spirit is through helping other people. And when you help other people, suddenly at 7 years sober, you can say, you know what, I've not been entirely honest about what happened with that woman. I want to tell you the truth. And when I went back to Anna to talk about it, she said, you've been a wonderful father for 7 years. You don't need to talk to me about this anymore. And the other thing I'll say is what Jay was saying, you know, I had a really interesting character I sponsored. He was a bank robber. And a great musician, and just an all-around charismatic character. But he did a fifth step with me in my office years ago on his way to prison. He was about to go back to prison for something else he'd done, and he wanted to be clean, and he did a fifth step. And so many things came out in that fifth step, but my office looked different to me. It was that profound. When I stood up, it looked smaller. I don't know how else to describe it. But what I said to him, and I think this often happens in sponsorship, is you are sort of a oracle, vehicle for words that you don't know you're about to say. But what I said to him when I was done is I said, do you think because of all these things you've done that God doesn't love you? And he said, yes, that's what I think. And I said, well, all I can tell you is I just heard all this stuff and I still love you. And I don't know why I said that. I really don't. But it was absolutely true. I loved him more. And I said, so if I, a limited, flawed, not all that great guy, can really love you still, I'm wondering how you think God can't. And he didn't drink in prison, and he started AA in that prison, and he went to sweat lodges so that the Indians would trust him and come to the meetings. And instead of doing the 5 years he was sentenced to, they let him out on early release at 1 year. So I hope that, I always think it's better to tell experience than opinion, so.
I think, too, that the real vehicle, what we end up doing around here is you will have an experience or you'll do some seemingly unrelated thing way over here that affects you way over here. And you don't realize it until you've gone down the road a ways and you look back and you realize that that feeling or that attitude towards yourself has changed. What's happening here, I believe, is as we go along this path, we grow up emotionally, we deepen emotionally, that we don't have much depth of emotion. My joking little phrase is the depth of my shallowness knows no bounds. I mean, and as Matthew mentioned, you know, it's all about us all the time. I mean, it's a 24-hour cable channel. It's all about Billy all the time. Sometimes we're loving Billy, sometimes we're hating Billy, but it's always about Billy, you know. And as soon as you perform some experiences, you get involved and you're reaching out to other people, that deepens. And pretty soon it's not just about Billy, sometimes it's about Zach. Sometimes, you know, then it's about, and then pretty soon you have a depth of emotional, an array of emotions, you know. I mean, before there's just, you know, violence and love. You know, there's just like not a whole lot of in between. And after a while, you know, you get, you know, you kind of get some depth. And when that happens, we are relieved of the bondage of self. You know, I mean, that self-hatred is all about self. It's all self. Selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of our problems. And I will have an experience with somebody sitting and listening to a fifth step or something like that that will touch my heart. sometimes that's very disconcerting. You know, we fall in love with each other. We trust each other for some odd reason, because we're the most untrustworthy people you can imagine. But for some reason, we don't really lie to each other. I mean, in the end result, I mean, you know, we bullshit a little bit, you know. Pretty soon, we take that leap of faith, and you can tell when somebody's telling you the unadulterated truth, because it's not real cute, you know. And when that experience happens, when somebody's honest with me, it helps me to be honest with somebody else. And pretty soon, this self-loathing and self-hatred and stuff begins to fade away. You just don't have time for it anymore. And yes, you truly do realize is that your greatest weakness becomes your greatest strength. The fact that you've done these, committed these crimes, or whatever it is that you've done, is why this other person trusts you and is able to talk to you, because they know you've been in the same place. That's all well and true. But I think really what happens is we just get relieved of the bondage of self. You know, it's like Einstein said, when you look at the whole universe and how wonderful it is, when you think about yourself, you come to realize that there's a lot of better things to be thinking about. You know, it's just not that interesting. You know, I mean, after, you know, I'm 26 years sober, 63 years old, I'm pretty much bored to tears with myself. You know, there's just not, I mean, what else can I think about me? It's just all reruns now, you know. But you, on the other hand, are a never-ending font of weirdness.
All right. You want to do some meditating on the way out?
Yeah, let's seal this up with 3 minutes, okay?
Hey, if I could I close with a song that
absolutely. Yeah. Please, come on up. We need somebody with some real spirituality. Please.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right. We'll see you tomorrow.
Tomorrow morning.
See you in the morning. We'll be able to do a meditation at 7:30 and...